"Clear that away," said the officer, pointing to the beams and the corpses. And the French soldiers, after dispatching the wounded, threw the corpses over the parapet. Who these men were, nobody knew. "Clear that away," was all that was said of them. And they were thrown over the parapet and removed later on that they might not stink. Thiers alone dedicates a few eloquent lines to their memory. "These wretches had occupied the sacred citadel, having supplied themselves with guns from the arsenal, and fired, the wretches, at the French. Some of them were sabred, and the Kremlin was purged of their presence." Murat was informed that the way had been cleared. The French entered the gates and began pitching their camp in the Senate Square. Out of the windows of the Senate House, the soldiers threw chairs into the square for fuel and kindled fires there. Other detachments passed through the Kremlin and encamped along the Morosieka, the Lubyanka, and Pokrovska streets. Others quartered themselves along the Vozdvizhenka, the Nikolsky, and the Tverskoy streets. No masters of the houses being found anywhere, the French were not billeted on the inhabitants, as is usual in towns, but lived in it as in a camp. Though tattered, hungry, worn out, and reduced to a third of their original number, the French entered Moscow in good marching order. It was a weary and famished, but still a fighting and menacing army. But it remained an army only until its soldiers had dispersed into their different lodgings. As soon as the men of the various regiments began to disperse among the wealthy and deserted houses, the army was lost forever, and there came into being something nondescript, neither citizens nor soldiers, but what are known as marauders. When 5 weeks later these same men left Moscow, they no longer formed an army. They were a mob of marauders, each carrying a quantity of articles which seemed to him valuable or useful. The aim of each man when he left Moscow was no longer, as it had been, to conquer, but merely to keep what he had acquired. Like a monkey which puts its paw into the narrow neck of a jug, and having seized a handful of nuts will not open its fist for fear of losing what it holds and therefore perishes, the French, when they left Moscow, had inevitably to perish because they carried their loot with them. Yet to abandon what they had stolen was as impossible for them as it is for the monkey to open its paw and let go of its nuts. 10 minutes after each regiment had entered a Moscow district, not a soldier or officer was left. Men in military uniforms and Hessian boots could be seen through the windows, laughing and walking through the rooms. In cellars and storerooms, similar men were busy among the provisions. And in the yards, unlocking or breaking open coach houses and stable doors, lighting fires in kitchens and kneading and baking bread with rolled up sleeves and cooking, or frightening, amusing, or caressing women and children. There were many such men, both in the shops and houses. But there was no army. Order after order was issued by the French commanders that day, forbidding the men to disperse about the town, sternly forbidding any violence to the inhabitants or any looting, and announcing a roll call for that very evening. But despite all these measures, the men who had till then constituted an army flowed all over the wealthy, deserted city with its comforts and plentiful supplies. As a hungry herd of cattle keeps well together when crossing a barren field, but gets out of hand and at once disperses uncontrollably as soon as it reaches rich pastures, so did the army disperse all over the wealthy city. No residents were left in Moscow, and the soldiers, like water percolating through sand, spread irresistibly through the city in all directions from the Kremlin into which they had first marched. The cavalry, on entering a merchant's house that had been abandoned, and finding their stabling more than sufficient for their horses, went on all the same to the next house, which seemed to them better. Many of them appropriated several houses, chalked their names on them, and quarreled and even fought with other companies for them. Before they had had time to secure quarters, the soldiers ran out into the streets to see the city, and hearing that everything had been abandoned, rushed to places where valuables were to be had for the taking. The officers followed to check the soldiers and were involuntarily drawn into doing the same thing. In Carriage Row, carriages had been left in the shops, and generals flocked there to select calèches and coaches for themselves. The few inhabitants who had remained invited commanding officers to their houses, hoping thereby to secure themselves from being plundered. There were masses of wealth, and there seemed no end to it. All around the quarters occupied by the French were other regions still unexplored and unoccupied, where, they thought, yet greater riches might be found. And Moscow engulfed the army ever deeper and deeper. When water is spilled on dry ground, both the dry ground and the water disappear, and mud results. And in the same way, the entry of the famished army into the rich and deserted city resulted in fires and looting and the destruction of both the army and the wealthy city. The French attributed the fire of Moscow au patriotisme féroce de Rostopchine, to Rostopchine's ferocious patriotism, the Russians to the barbarity of the French. In reality, however, it was not and could not be possible to explain the burning of Moscow by making any individual or any group of people responsible for it. Moscow was burned because it found itself in a position in which any town built of wood was bound to burn, quite apart from whether it had or had not 130 inferior fire engines. Deserted Moscow had to burn as inevitably as a heap of shavings has to burn, on which sparks continually fall for several days. A town built of wood, where scarcely a day passes without conflagrations when the house owners are in residence and a police force is present, cannot help burning when its inhabitants have left it and it is occupied by soldiers who smoke pipes, make campfires of the Senate chairs in the Senate Square, and cook themselves meals twice a day. In peacetime, it is only necessary to billet troops in the villages of any district, and the number of fires in that district immediately increases. How much, then, must the probability of fire be increased in an abandoned wooden town where foreign troops are quartered? Le patriotisme féroce de Rostopchine and the barbarity of the French were not to blame in the matter. Moscow was set on fire by the soldiers' pipes, kitchens, and campfires, and by the carelessness of enemy soldiers occupying houses they did not own. Even if there was any arson, which is very doubtful, for no one had any reason to burn the houses, in any case a troublesome and dangerous thing to do, arson cannot be regarded as the cause, for the same thing would have happened without any incendiarism. However tempting it might be for the French to blame Rostopchine's ferocity, and for Russians to blame the scoundrel Bonaparte, or later on to place an heroic torch in the hands of their own people, it is impossible not to see that there could be no such direct cause of the fire. For Moscow had to burn, as every village, factory, or house must burn, which is left by its owners, and in which strangers are allowed to live and cook their porridge. Moscow was burned by its inhabitants, it is true, but by those who had abandoned it, and not by those who remained in it. Moscow, when occupied by the enemy, did not remain intact like Berlin, Vienna, and other towns, simply because its inhabitants abandoned it and did not welcome the French with bread and salt, nor bring them the keys of the city. Chapter 14. Pierre, his plan to kill Napoleon. Bazdieff's drunken brother fires at Captain Rambal, who regards Pierre as a friend. The absorption of the French by Moscow, radiating star-wise as it did, only reached the quarter where Pierre was staying by the evening of the 2nd of September. After the last 2 days spent in solitude and unusual circumstances, Pierre was in a state bordering on insanity. He was completely obsessed by one persistent thought. He did not know how or when this thought had taken such possession of him, but he remembered nothing of the past, understood nothing of the present, and all he saw and heard appeared to him like a dream. He had left home only to escape the intricate tangle of life's demands that enmeshed him, and which in his present condition he was unable to unravel. He had gone to Joseph Alexeyevich's house, on the plea of sorting the deceased's books and papers, only in search of rest from life's turmoil. For in his mind, the memory of Joseph Alexeyevich was connected with a world of eternal, solemn, and calm thoughts, quite contrary to the restless confusion into which he felt himself being drawn. He sought a quiet refuge, and in Joseph Alexeyevich's study he really found it. When he sat with his elbows on the dusty writing table in the deathlike stillness of the study, calm and significant memories of the last few days rose one after another in his imagination, particularly of the Battle of Borodino, and of that vague sense of his own insignificance and insincerity compared with the truth, simplicity, and strength of the class of men he mentally classed as they. When Gerasim roused him from his reverie, the idea occurred to him of taking part in the popular defense of Moscow, which he knew was projected. And with that object, he had asked Gerasim to get him a peasant's coat and a pistol, confiding to him his intentions of remaining in Joseph Alexeyevich's house and keeping his name secret. Then, during the first day spent in inaction and solitude, he tried several times to fix his attention on the Masonic manuscripts, but was unable to do so, the idea that had previously occurred to him of the Kabbalistic significance of his name in connection with Bonaparte's more than once vaguely presented itself. But the idea that he, Le Russe Bezukhov, was destined to set a limit to the power of the beast was as yet only one of the fancies that often passed through his mind and left no trace behind. When, having bought the coat merely with the object of taking part among the people in the defense of Moscow, Pierre had met the Rostovs, and Natasha had said to him, "Are you remaining in Moscow? How splendid!" The thought flashed into his mind that it really would be a good thing, even if Moscow were taken, for him to remain there and do what he was predestined to do. Next day, with the sole idea of not sparing himself and not lagging in any way behind them, Pierre went to the Three Hills gate. But when he returned to the house, convinced that Moscow would not be defended, he suddenly felt that what before had seemed to him merely a possibility had now become absolutely necessary and inevitable. He must remain in Moscow, concealing his name, and must meet Napoleon and kill him, and either perish or put an end to the misery of all Europe, which it seemed to him was solely due to Napoleon. Pierre knew all the details of the attempt on Bonaparte's life in 1809 by a German student in Vienna, and knew that the student had been shot, and the risk to which he would expose his life by carrying out his design excited him still more. Two equally strong feelings drew Pierre irresistibly to this purpose. The first was a feeling of the necessity of sacrifice and suffering in view of the common calamity, the same feeling that had caused him to go to Mozhaisk on the 25th and to make his way to the very thick of the battle, and had now caused him to run away from his home and, in place of the luxury and comfort to which he was accustomed, to sleep on a hard sofa without undressing and eat the same food as Gerasim. The other was that vague and quite Russian feeling of contempt for everything conventional, artificial, and human, for everything the majority of men regard as the greatest good in the world. Pierre had first experienced this strange and fascinating feeling at the Sloboda Palace, when he had suddenly felt that wealth, power, and life, all that men so painstakingly acquire and guard, if it has any worth, has so only by reason of the joy with which it can all be renounced. It was the feeling that induces a volunteer recruit to spend his last penny on drink, and a drunken man to smash mirrors or glasses for no apparent reason, and knowing that it will cost him all the money he possesses. The feeling which causes a man to perform actions which from an ordinary point of view are insane, to test, as it were, his personal power and strength, affirming the existence of a higher, non-human criterion of life. From the very day Pierre had experienced this feeling for the first time at the Sloboda Palace, he had been continuously under its influence, but only now found full satisfaction for it. Moreover, at this moment, Pierre was supported in his design and prevented from renouncing it by what he had already done in that direction. If he were now to leave Moscow like everyone else, His flight from home, the peasant coat, the pistol, and his announcement to the Rostovs that he would remain in Moscow would all become not merely meaningless, but contemptible and ridiculous. And to this Pierre was very sensitive. Pierre's physical condition, as is always the case, corresponded to his mental state. The unaccustomed coarse food, the vodka he drank during those days, the absence of wine and cigars, his dirty, unchanged linen, two almost sleepless nights passed on a short sofa without bedding, all this kept him in a state of excitement bordering on insanity. It was 2 o'clock in the afternoon. The French had already entered Moscow. Pierre knew this, but instead of acting, he only thought about his undertaking, going over its minutest details in his mind. In his fancy, he did not clearly picture to himself either the striking of the blow or the death of Napoleon, but with extraordinary vividness and melancholy enjoyment, imagined his own destruction and heroic endurance. Yes, alone, for the sake of all, I must do it or perish, he thought. Yes, I will approach. And then suddenly, the pistol or dagger? But that is all the same. It is not I, but the hand of Providence that punishes thee, I shall say, thought he, imagining what he would say when killing Napoleon. Well then, take me and execute me, he went on, speaking to himself and bowing his head with a sad but firm expression. While Pierre, standing in the middle of the room, was talking to himself in this way, the study door opened, and on the threshold appeared the figure of Makar Alexeyevich, always so timid before, but now quite transformed. His dressing gown was unfastened, his face red and distorted. He was obviously drunk. On seeing Pierre, he grew confused at first, but noticing embarrassment on Pierre's face, immediately grew bold, and, staggering on his thin legs, advanced into the middle of the room. "They're frightened," he said confidentially in a hoarse voice. "I say I won't surrender, I say. Am I not right, sir?" He paused, and then suddenly seeing the pistol on the table, seized it with unexpected rapidity and ran out into the corridor. Gerasim and the porter, who had followed Makar Alexeyevich, stopped him in the vestibule and tried to take the pistol from him. Pierre, coming out into the corridor, looked with pity and repulsion at the half-crazy old man. Makar Alexeyevich, frowning with exertion, held on to the pistol and screamed hoarsely, evidently with some heroic fancy in his head. "To arms! Board them! Oh, no, you shan't get it!" he yelled. "That will do, please, that will do. Have the goodness, please, sir, to let go. Please, sir," pleaded Gerasim, trying carefully to steer Makar Alexeyevich by the elbows back to the door. "Who are you?" "Bonaparte!" shouted Makar Alexeyevich. "That's not right, sir. Come to your room, please, and rest. Allow me to have the pistol." "Be off, thou base slave! Touch me not! See this!" shouted Makar Alexeyevich, brandishing the pistol. "Board them!" "Catch hold," whispered Gerasim to the porter. They seized Makar Alexeyevich by the arms and dragged him to the door. The vestibule was filled with the discordant sounds of a struggle and of a tipsy, hoarse voice. Suddenly, a fresh sound, a piercing feminine scream, reverberated from the porch, and the cook came running into the vestibule. "It's them! Gracious heavens, O Lord, four of them! Horsemen!" she cried. Gerasim and the porter let Makar Alexeyevich go, and in the now silent corridor the sound of several hands knocking at the front door could be heard. Pierre, having decided that until he had carried out his design he would disclose neither his identity nor his knowledge of French, stood at the half-open door of the corridor, intending to conceal himself as soon as the French entered. But the French entered, and still Pierre did not retire. An irresistible curiosity kept him there. There were two of them. One was an officer, a tall, soldierly, handsome man, the other evidently a private or an orderly, sunburned, short, and thin, with sunken cheeks and a dull expression. The officer walked in front, leaning on a stick and slightly limping. When he had advanced a few steps, he stopped, having apparently decided that these were good quarters, turned round to the soldiers standing at the entrance, and in a loud voice of command ordered them to put up the horses. Having done that, the officer, lifting his elbow with a smart gesture, stroked his moustache and lightly touched his hat. "Bonjour, la compagnie." "Good day, everybody," said he gaily, smiling and looking about him. No one gave any reply. "Vous êtes le bourgeois?" "Are you the master here?" the officer asked Gerasim. Gerasim gazed at the officer with an alarmed and inquiring look.
"Quartier. Quartier, logement."
"Quarters, quarters, lodging," said the officer, looking down at the little man with a condescending and good-natured smile.
"Les Français sont des bons enfants." "Que diable, voyons, ne nous fâchons pas, mon vieux."
"The French are good fellows. What the devil, there, don't let us be cross, old fellow," added he, clapping the scared and silent Gerasim on the shoulder. "Well, does no one speak French in this establishment?" he asked again in French, looking around and meeting Pierre's eyes. Pierre moved away from the door. Again the officer turned to Gerasim and asked him to show him the rooms in the house.
"Master, not here. Don't understand me, you," said Gerasim,
trying to render his words more comprehensible by contorting them. Still smiling, the French officer spread out his hands before Gerasim's nose, intimating that he did not understand him either, and moved limping to the door at which Pierre was standing. Pierre wished to go away and conceal himself, but at that moment he saw Makar Alexeyevich appearing at the open kitchen door with a pistol in his hand. With a madman's cunning, Makar Alexeyevich eyed the Frenchman, raised his pistol, and took aim.
"Board them!"
yelled the tipsy man, trying to press the trigger. Hearing the yell, the officer turned round, and at the same moment Pierre threw himself on the drunkard. Just when Pierre snatched at and struck up the pistol, Makar Alexeyevich at last got his fingers on the trigger. There was a deafening report, and all were enveloped in a cloud of smoke. The Frenchman turned pale and rushed to the door. Forgetting his intention of concealing his knowledge of French, Pierre, snatching away the pistol and throwing it down, ran up to the officer and addressed him in French. "You're not wounded?" he asked. "I think not," answered the Frenchman, feeling himself over. "But I've had a lucky escape this time," he added, pointing to the damaged plaster of the wall. "Who is that man?" said he, looking sternly at Pierre. "Oh, I'm really in despair at what has occurred," said Pierre rapidly, quite forgetting the part he had intended to play. "He's an unfortunate madman who did not know what he was doing." The officer went up to Makar Alexeyevich and took him by the collar. Makar Alexeyevich was standing with parted lips, swaying as if about to fall asleep, as he leaned against the wall.
"Brigand, you shall pay for this," said the Frenchman, letting go of him. "We French are merciful after victory, but we do not pardon traitors," he added with a look of gloomy dignity and a fine, energetic gesture.
Pierre continued in French to persuade the officer not to hold that drunken imbecile to account. The Frenchman listened in silence with the same gloomy expression, but suddenly turned to Pierre with a smile. For a few seconds he looked at him in silence. His handsome face assumed a melodramatically gentle expression, and he held out his hand. "You have saved my life. You are French," said he. For a Frenchman, that deduction was indubitable. Only a Frenchman could perform a great deed, and to save his life, the life of Monsieur Ramballe, captain of the 13th Light Regiment, was undoubtedly a very great deed. But however indubitable that conclusion and the officer's conviction based upon it, Pierre felt it necessary to disillusion him. "I am Russian," he said quickly.
"Tut, tut, tut, tell that to others," said the officer, waving his finger before his nose and smiling. "You shall tell me all about that presently. I'm delighted to meet a compatriot. Well, and what are we to do with this man?" he added, addressing himself to Pierre as to a brother.
Even if Pierre were not a Frenchman, having once received that loftiest of human appellations, he could not renounce it, said the officer's look and tone. In reply to his last question, Pierre again explained who Makar Alexeyevich was, and how just before their arrival that drunken imbecile had seized the loaded pistol which they had not had time to recover from him, and begged the officer to let the deed go unpunished. The Frenchman expanded his chest and made a majestic gesture with his arm.
"You have saved my life. You are French. You ask his pardon? I grant it you. Lead that man away, said he quickly and energetically, and taking the arm of Pierre, whom he had promoted to be a Frenchman for saving his life, he went with him into the room. The soldiers in the yard, hearing the shot, came into the passage asking what had happened, and expressed their readiness to punish the culprits, but the officer sternly checked them. You will be called in when you are wanted, he said. The soldiers went out again, and the orderly, who had meanwhile had time to visit the kitchen, came up to his officer. Captain, there is soup and a leg of mutton in the kitchen, said he. Shall I serve them up? Yes, and some wine, answered the captain. When the French officer went into the room with Pierre, the latter again thought it his duty to assure him that he was not French and wished to go away, but the officer would not hear of it. He was so very polite, amiable, good-natured, and genuinely grateful to Pierre for saving his life that Pierre had not the heart to refuse and sat down with him in the parlor, the first room they entered. To Pierre's assurances that he was not a Frenchman, the captain, evidently not understanding how anyone could decline so flattering an appellation, shrugged his shoulders and said that if Pierre absolutely insisted on passing for a Russian, let it be so. But for all that, he would be forever bound to Pierre by gratitude for saving his life. Had this man been endowed with the slightest capacity for perceiving the feelings of others, and had he at all understood what Pierre's feelings were, the latter would probably have left him. But the man's animated obtuseness to everything other than himself disarmed Pierre. A Frenchman, or a Russian prince incognito, said the officer, looking at Pierre's fine though dirty linen and at the ring on his finger. I owe you my life and offer you my friendship. A Frenchman never forgets either an insult or a service. I offer you my friendship. That is all I can say. There was so much good nature and nobility, in the French sense of the word, in the officer's voice, in the expression of his face and in his gestures, that Pierre, unconsciously smiling in response to the Frenchman's smile, pressed the hand held out to him. Captain Rambal of the 13th Light Regiment, Chevalier of the Legion of Honor for the affair on the 7th of September, he introduced himself, a self-satisfied, irrepressible smile puckering his lips under his moustache. The affair of the 7th of September was Borodino. Will you now be so good as to tell me with whom I have the honor of conversing so pleasantly, instead of being in the ambulance with that maniac's bullet in my body? Pierre replied that he could not tell him his name, and, blushing, began to try to invent a name and to say something about his reason for concealing it. But the Frenchman hastily interrupted him. Oh, please, said he, I understand your reasons. You are an officer. A superior officer, perhaps. You've borne arms against us. That's not my business. I owe you my life. That is enough for me. I'm quite at your service. You belong to the gentry? He included with a shade of inquiry in his tone. Pierre bent his head. Your baptismal name, if you please. That is all I ask. Monsieur Pierre, you say. Excellent. That's all I want to know. When the mutton and an omelette had been served, and a samovar and vodka brought, with some wine which the French had taken from a Russian cellar and brought with them, Rambal invited Pierre to share his dinner, and himself began to eat greedily and quickly, like a healthy and hungry man, munching his food rapidly with his strong teeth, continually smacking his lips and repeating, "Excellent, delicious." His face grew red and was covered with perspiration. Pierre was hungry and shared the dinner with pleasure. Morel, the orderly, brought some hot water in a saucepan and placed a bottle of claret in it. He also brought a bottle of kvass taken from the kitchen for them to try. That beverage was already known to the French and had been given a special name. They called it limonade de cochon, pig's lemonade, and Morel spoke well of the limonade de cochon he had found in the kitchen. But as the captain had the wine they had taken while passing through Moscow, he left the kvass to Morel and applied himself to the bottle of Bordeaux. He wrapped the bottle up to its neck in a table napkin and poured out wine for himself and for Pierre. The satisfaction of his hunger and the wine rendered the captain still more lively, and he chatted incessantly all through dinner. Yes, my dear Monsieur Pierre, I owe you a fine votive candle for saving me from that maniac. You see, I have bullets enough in my body already. Here's one I got at Wagram, he touched his side, and a second at Smolensk, he showed a scar on his cheek. And this leg, which, as you see, does not want to march, I got that on the 7th at the great battle of La Moscova. Note, the French called the Battle of Borodino La Moscova, and the Frenchman naturally gives the date new style as September 7th, whereas the Russians called it August 26th. Sacré Dieu! It was splendid! That deluge of fire was worth seeing. It was a tough job you set us there, my word. You may be proud of it. And on my honor, in spite of the cough I caught there, I should be ready to begin again. I pity those who did not see it. I was there, said Pierre. Ah, really? So much the better. You are certainly brave foes. The great redoubt held out well by my pipe, continued the Frenchman. And you made us pay dear for it. I was at it 3 times, sure as I sit here. 3 times we reached the guns, and 3 times we were thrown back like cardboard figures. Oh, it was beautiful, Monsieur Pierre. Your grenadiers were splendid, by heaven. I saw them close up their ranks 6 times in succession and march as if on parade. Fine fellows. Our King of Naples, who knows what's what, cried, Bravo! So you're one of us soldiers, he added, smiling after a momentary pause. So much the better, so much the better, Monsieur Pierre. Terrible in battle, gallant with the fair. He winked and smiled. That's what the French are, Monsieur Pierre, aren't they? The captain was so naively and good-humoredly gay, so real and so pleased with himself, that Pierre almost winked back as he looked merrily at him. Probably the word gallant turned the captain's thoughts to the state of Moscow. Apropos, tell me, please, is it true that the women have all left Moscow? What a queer idea. What are they to be afraid of? Would not the French ladies leave Paris if the Russians entered it? Asked Pierre. The Frenchman emitted a merry, sanguine chuckle, patting Pierre on the shoulder. What a thing to say, he exclaimed. Paris? But Paris... Paris... Paris, the capital of the world, Pierre finished his remark for him. The captain looked at Pierre. He had a habit of stopping short in the middle of his talk and gazing intently with his laughing, kindly eyes. Well, if you hadn't told me you were Russian, I should have wagered that you were Parisian. You have that... I don't know what, that... And having uttered this compliment, he again gazed at him in silence. I've been in Paris. I spent years there, said Pierre. Oh, yes, one sees that plainly. Paris... A man who doesn't know Paris is a savage. You can tell a Parisian 2 leagues off. Paris is Talma, La Duchesnois, Poitiers, the Sorbonne, the Boulevards. Note, Captain Lamballe, in enumerating the attractions of Paris, mentions indiscriminately the famous tragedian Talma, a favorite of Napoleon's, the actress Duchesnois, the comedian Poitiers, the Sorbonne, the University of Paris, and the Boulevards. And noticing that his conclusion was weaker than what had gone before, he added quickly, There is only one Paris in the world. You've been to Paris and have remained Russian. Well, I don't esteem you the less for it.
Under the influence of the wine he had drunk, and after the days he had spent alone with his depressing thoughts, Pierre involuntarily enjoyed talking with this cheerful and good-natured man, Captain Ramballe. To return to your ladies... said Ramballe. I hear they are lovely. What a wretched idea to go and bury themselves in the steppes when the French army is in Moscow. What a chance those girls have missed. You are peasants now. That's another thing. But you civilized people, you ought to know us better than that. We took Vienna, Berlin, Madrid, Naples, Rome, Warsaw, all the world's capitals. We're feared, but we're loved. We're nice to know. And then the Emperor... he began, but Pierre interrupted him. The Emperor? Pierre repeated, and his face suddenly became sad and embarrassed. Is the Emperor... The Emperor? He's generosity, mercy, justice, order, genius. That's what the Emperor is. It is I, Ramballe, who tell you so. I assure you, I was his enemy 8 years ago. My father was an emigrant count. But that man has vanquished me. He's taken hold of me. I could not resist the sight of the grandeur and glory with which he has covered France. When I understood what he wanted, when I saw that he was preparing a bed of laurels for us, you know, I said to myself, that is a monarch, and I devoted myself to him. So there, oh yes, mon cher, he is the greatest man of the ages, past or future.
Is he in Moscow? Pierre stammered with a guilty look. The Frenchman looked at his guilty face and smiled. No, he will make his entry tomorrow, he replied, and continued his talk. Their conversation was interrupted by the cries of several voices at the gate, and by Morel, who came to say that some Württemberg hussars had come and wanted to put up their horses in the yard where the captain's horses were. This difficulty had arisen chiefly because the hussars did not understand what was said to them in French. The captain had their senior sergeant called in, and in a stern voice asked him to what regiment he belonged, who was his commanding officer, and by what right he allowed himself to claim quarters that were already occupied. The German, who knew little French, answered the two first questions by giving the names of his regiment and of his commanding officer, but in reply to the third question, which he did not understand, said, introducing broken French into his own German, that he was the quartermaster of the regiment, and his commander had ordered him to occupy all the houses one after another. Pierre, who knew German, translated what the German said to the captain, and gave the captain's reply to the Württemberg hussar in German. When he had understood what was said to him, the German submitted and took his men elsewhere. The captain went out into the porch and gave some orders in a loud voice. When he returned to the room, Pierre was sitting in the same place as before, with his head in his hands. His face expressed suffering. He really was suffering at that moment. When the captain went out and he was left alone, suddenly he came to himself and realized the position he was in. It was not that Moscow had been taken, or that the happy conquerors were masters in it and were patronizing him. Painful as that was, it was not that which tormented Pierre at the moment. He was tormented by the consciousness of his own weakness. The few glasses of wine he had drunk, and the conversation with this good-natured man, had destroyed the mood of concentrated gloom in which he had spent the last few days, and which was essential for the execution of his design. The pistol, dagger, and peasant coat were ready. Napoleon was to enter the town next day. Pierre still considered that it would be a useful and worthy action to slay the evildoer. But now he felt that he would not do it. He did not know why, but he felt a foreboding that he would not carry out his intention. He struggled against the confession of his weakness, but dimly felt that he could not overcome it, and that his former gloomy frame of mind concerning vengeance, killing, and self-sacrifice had been dispersed like dust by contact with the first man he met. The captain returned to the room, limping slightly and whistling a tune. The Frenchman's chatter, which had previously amused Pierre, now repelled him. The tune he was whistling, his gait, and the gesture with which he twirled his moustache, all now seemed offensive. I will go away immediately. I won't say another word to him, thought Pierre. He thought this, but still sat in the same place. A strange feeling of weakness tied him to the spot. He wished to get up and go away, but could not do so. The captain, on the other hand, seemed very cheerful. He paced up and down the room twice. His eyes shone, and his moustache twitched as if he were smiling to himself at some amusing thought. The colonel of those Württembergers is delightful, he suddenly said. He's a German, but a nice fellow all the same. But he's a German. He sat down facing Pierre. By the way, you know German, then? Pierre looked at him in silence. What is the German for shelter? Shelter? Pierre repeated. The German for shelter is Unterkunft. How do you say it? The captain asked quickly and doubtfully. Unterkunft, Pierre repeated. Unterkunft, said the captain, and looked at Pierre for some seconds with laughing eyes. These Germans are first-rate fools, don't you think so, Monsieur Pierre? He concluded. Well, let's have another bottle of this Moscow Bordeaux, shall we? Morel will warm us up another little bottle. Morel! He called out gaily. Morel brought candles and a bottle of wine. The captain looked at Pierre by the candlelight and was evidently struck by the troubled expression on his companion's face. Rambal, with genuine distress and sympathy in his face, went up to Pierre and bent over him. There now, we're sad. said he, touching Pierre's hand. "Have I upset you?" "No, really. Have you anything against me?" he asked Pierre. "Perhaps it's the state of affairs?" Pierre did not answer, but looked cordially into the Frenchman's eyes, whose expression of sympathy was pleasing to him. "Honestly, without speaking of what I owe you, I feel friendship for you. Can I do anything for you? Dispose of me. It is for life and death. I say it with my hand on my heart," said he, striking his chest. "Thank you," said Pierre. The captain gazed intently at him, as he had done when he learned that Shelter was Unterkunft in German, and his face suddenly brightened. "Well, in that case, I drink to our friendship," he cried gaily, filling two glasses with wine. Pierre took one of the glasses and emptied it. Rambal emptied his too, again pressed Pierre's hand, and leaned his elbows on the table in a pensive attitude. "Yes, my dear friend," he began, "such is fortune's caprice. Who would have said that I should be a soldier and a captain of dragoons in the service of Bonaparte, as we used to call him? Yet here I am in Moscow with him. I must tell you, mon cher," he continued in the sad and measured tones of a man who intends to tell a long story, "that our name is one of the most ancient in France." And with a Frenchman's easy and naive frankness, the captain told Pierre the story of his ancestors, his childhood, youth, and manhood, and all about his relations and his financial and family affairs. Ma pauvre mère playing, of course, an important part in the story. "But all that is only life's setting. The real thing is love, love. Am I not right, Monsieur Pierre?" said he, growing animated. "Another glass?" Pierre again emptied his glass and poured himself out a third. "Oh, women, women." And the captain, looking with glistening eyes at Pierre, began talking of love and of his love affairs. There were very many of these, as one could easily believe, looking at the officer's handsome, self-satisfied face and noting the eager enthusiasm with which he spoke of women. Though all Rambal's love stories had the sensual character which Frenchmen regard as the special charm and poetry of love, yet he told his story with such sincere conviction that he alone had experienced and known all the charm of love, and he described women so alluringly that Pierre listened to him with curiosity. It was plain that l'amour, which the Frenchman was so fond of, was not that low and simple kind that Pierre had once felt for his wife, nor was it the romantic love stimulated by himself that he experienced for Natasha. Rambal despised both these kinds of love equally, the one he considered the love of clodhoppers, and the other the love of simpletons. L'amour which the Frenchman worshipped consisted principally in the unnaturalness of his relation to the woman, and in a combination of incongruities giving the chief charm to the feeling. Thus the captain touchingly recounted the story of his love for a fascinating marquise of 35, and at the same time for a charming, innocent child of 17, daughter of the bewitching marquise. The conflict of magnanimity between the mother and the daughter, ending in the mother's sacrificing herself and offering her daughter in marriage to her lover, even now agitated the captain, though it was the memory of a distant past. Then he recounted an episode in which the husband played the part of the lover, and he, the lover, assumed the role of the husband, as well as several droll incidents from his recollections of Germany, where Shelter is called Unterkunft, and where the husbands eat sauerkraut and the young girls are too blonde. Finally, the latest episode in Poland, still fresh in the captain's memory, and which he narrated with rapid gestures and glowing face, was of how he had saved the life of a Pole. In general, the saving of life continually occurred in the captain's stories, and the Pole had entrusted to him his enchanting wife, Parisienne de cœur, Parisian at heart, while himself entering the French service. The captain was happy. The enchanting Polish lady wished to elope with him, but prompted by magnanimity, the captain restored the wife to the husband, saying as he did so, "I have saved your life, and I save your honor." Having repeated these words, the captain wiped his eyes and gave himself a shake, as if driving away the weakness which assailed him at this touching recollection. Listening to the captain's tales, Pierre, as often happens late in the evening and under the influence of wine, followed all that was told him, understood it all, and at the same time followed a train of personal memories which, he knew not why, suddenly arose in his mind. While listening to these love stories, his own love for Natasha unexpectedly rose to his mind, and going over the pictures of that love in his imagination, he mentally compared them with Rambal's tales. Listening to the story of the struggle between love and duty, Pierre saw before his eyes every minutest detail of his last meeting with the object of his love at the Sukharyev water tower. At the time of that meeting, it had not produced an effect upon him. He had not even once recalled it. But now it seemed to him that that meeting had had in it something very important and poetic. "Peter Kirillovich, come here. We have recognized you." He now seemed to hear the words she had uttered, and to see before him her eyes, her smile, her traveling hood, and a stray lock of her hair. And there seemed to him something pathetic and touching in all this. Having finished his tale about the enchanting Polish lady, the captain asked Pierre if he had ever experienced a similar impulse to sacrifice himself for love and a feeling of envy of the legitimate husband. Challenged by this question, Pierre raised his head and felt a need to express the thoughts that filled his mind. He began to explain that he understood love for a woman somewhat differently. He said that in all his life he had loved and still loved only one woman, and that she could never be his.
"Tiens," said the captain.
Pierre then explained that he had loved this woman from his earliest years, but that he had not dared to think of her because she was too young, and because he had been an illegitimate son without a name. Afterwards, when he had received a name and wealth, he dared not think of her because he loved her too well, placing her far above everything in the world, and especially, therefore, above himself. When he had reached this point, Pierre asked the captain whether he understood that. The captain made a gesture signifying that even if he did not understand it, he begged Pierre to continue. "Platonic love. Clouds," he muttered. Whether it was the wine he had drunk, or an impulse of frankness, or the thought that this man did not and never would know any of those who played a part in his story, or whether it was all these things together, something loosened Pierre's tongue. Speaking thickly and with a faraway look in his shining eyes, he told the whole story of his life. His marriage, Natasha's love for his best friend, her betrayal of him, and all his own simple relations with her. Urged on by Rambal's questions, he also told what he had at first concealed, his own position, and even his name. More than anything else in Pierre's story, the captain was impressed by the fact that Pierre was very rich, had two mansions in Moscow, and that he had abandoned everything and not left the city, but remained there, concealing his name and station. When it was late at night, they went out together into the street. The night was warm and light. To the left of the house, on the Pokrovka, a fire glowed, the first of those that were beginning in Moscow. To the right, and high up in the sky, was the sickle of the waning moon, and opposite to it hung that bright comet which was connected in Pierre's heart with his love. At the gate stood Gerasim, the cook, and two Frenchmen. Their laughter and their mutually incomprehensible remarks in two languages could be heard. They were looking at the glow seen in the town. There was nothing terrible in the one small, distant fire in the immense city. Gazing at the high, starry sky, at the moon, at the comet, and at the glow from the fire, Pierre experienced a joyful emotion. "There now. How good it is! What more does one need?" thought he. And suddenly remembering his intention, he grew dizzy and felt so faint that he leaned against the fence to save himself from falling. Without taking leave of his new friend, Pierre left the gate with unsteady steps, and returning to his room lay down on the sofa and immediately fell asleep. Chapter 15. The Rostovs at Mitishchi. Natasha sees Prince Andrew. The glow of the first fire that began on the 2nd of September was watched from the various roads by the fugitive Muscovites and by the retreating troops with many different feelings. The Rostov party spent the night at Mitishchi, 14 miles from Moscow. They had started so late on the 1st of September, the road had been so blocked by vehicles and troops, so many things had been forgotten for which servants were sent back, that they had decided to spend that night at a place 3 miles out of Moscow. The next morning, they woke late and were again delayed so often that they only got as far as Great Mitishchi. At 10 o'clock that evening, the Rostov family and the wounded traveling with them were all distributed in the yards and huts of that large village. The Rostovs' servants and coachmen and the orderlies of the wounded officers, after attending to their masters, had supper, fed the horses, and came out into the porches. In a neighboring hut lay Raevsky's adjutant with a fractured wrist. The awful pain he suffered made him moan incessantly and piteously, and his moaning sounded terrible in the darkness of the autumn night. He had spent the first night in the same yard as the Rostovs. The countess said she had been unable to close her eyes on account of his moaning, and at Mitishchi she moved into a worse hut simply to be farther away from the wounded man. In the darkness of the night, one of the servants noticed above the high body of a coach standing before the porch the small glow of another fire. One glow had long been visible, and everybody knew that it was little Mitishchi burning, set on fire by Mamonov's Cossacks. "But look here, brothers. There's another fire," remarked an orderly. All turned their attention to the glow. "But they told us little Mitishchi had been set on fire by Mamonov's Cossacks. But that's not Mitishchi, it's farther away." "Look, it must be in Moscow." Two of the gazers went round to the other side of the coach and sat down on its steps. "Well, it's more to the left. Why, little Mitishchi is over there, and this is right on the other side." Several men joined the first two. "See how it's flaring," said one. "That's a fire in Moscow, either in the Sushchevsky or the Rogozhsky quarter." No one replied to this remark, and for some time they all gazed silently at the spreading flames of the second fire in the distance. Old Daniel Terentich, the Count's valet, as he was called, came up to the group and shouted at Mishka, "What are you staring at, you good-for-nothing? The Count will be calling and there's nobody there. Go and gather the clothes together."
"I only ran out to get some water," said Mishka.
"But what do you think, Daniel Terentich? Doesn't it look as if that glow were in Moscow?" remarked one of the footmen. Daniel Terentich made no reply, and again for a long time they were all silent. The glow spread, rising and falling, farther and farther still.
"God have mercy. It's windy and dry," said another voice.
"Just look! See what it's doing now! Oh, Lord, you can even see the crows flying! Lord, have mercy on us sinners."
"They'll put it out, no fear."
"Who's to put it out?" Daniel Terentich, who had hitherto been silent, was heard to say. His voice was calm and deliberate.
"Moscow it is, brothers," said he. "Mother Moscow. The white..."
His voice faltered, and he gave way to an old man's sob. And it was as if they had all only waited for this, to realize the significance for them of the glow they were watching. Sighs were heard, words of prayer, and the sobbing of the Count's old valet. The valet, returning to the cottage, informed the Count that Moscow was burning. The Count donned his dressing gown and went out to look. Sonya and Madame Schoss, who had not yet undressed, went out with him. Only Natasha and the Countess remained in the room. Petya was no longer with the family. He had gone on with his regiment, which was making for Troitsa. The Countess, on hearing that Moscow was on fire, began to cry. Natasha, pale, with a fixed look, was sitting on the bench under the icons just where she had sat down on arriving, and paid no attention to her father's words. She was listening to the ceaseless moaning of the adjutant three houses off.
"Oh, how terrible," said Sonya, returning from the yard, chilled and frightened. "I believe the whole of Moscow will burn. There's an awful glow. Natasha, do look, you can see it from the window," she said to her cousin, evidently wishing to distract her mind. But Natasha looked at her as if not understanding what was said to her, and again fixed her eyes on the corner of the stove. She had been in this condition of stupor since the morning, when Sonya, to the surprise and annoyance of the countess, had for some unaccountable reason found it necessary to tell Natasha of Prince Andrew's wound and of his being with their party. The countess had seldom been so angry with anyone as she was with Sonya. Sonya had cried and begged to be forgiven, and now, as if trying to atone for her fault, paid unceasing attention to her cousin.
"Look, Natasha, how dreadfully it is burning," said she.
"What's burning?" asked Natasha.
"Oh, yes, Moscow."
And as if in order not to offend Sonya and to get rid of her, she turned her face to the window, looked out in such a way that it was evident that she could not see anything, and again settled down in her former attitude.
"But you didn't see it."
"Yes, really, I did," Natasha replied in a voice that pleaded to be left in peace. Both the countess and Sonya understood that, naturally, neither Moscow nor the burning of Moscow nor anything else could seem of importance to Natasha. The count returned and lay down behind the partition. The countess went up to her daughter and touched her head with the back of her hand, as she was wont to do when Natasha was ill, then touched her forehead with her lips, as if to feel whether she was feverish, and finally kissed her.
"You're cold. You're trembling all over. You'd better lie down," said the countess.
"Lie down? All right, I will. I'll lie down at once," said Natasha. When Natasha had been told that morning that Prince Andrew was seriously wounded and was traveling with their party, she had at first asked many questions. Where was he going? How was he wounded? Was it serious? And could she see him? But after she had been told that she could not see him, that he was seriously wounded, but that his life was not in danger, she ceased to ask questions or to speak at all, evidently disbelieving what they told her, and convinced that, say what she might, she would still be told the same. All the way she had sat motionless in a corner of the coach, with wide-open eyes and the expression in them which the countess knew so well and feared so much. And now she sat in the same way on the bench where she had seated herself on arriving. She was planning something, and either deciding or had already decided something in her mind. The countess knew this, but what it might be, she did not know, and this alarmed and tormented her.
"Natasha, undress, darling. Lie down on my bed."
A bed had been made on a bedstead for the countess only. Madame Schoss and the two girls were to sleep on some hay on the floor.
"No, Mama, I will lie down here on the floor," Natasha replied irritably, and she went to the window and opened it.
Through the open window, the moans of the adjutant could be heard more distinctly. She put her head out into the damp night air, and the countess saw her slim neck shaking with sobs and throbbing against the window frame. Natasha knew it was not Prince Andrew who was moaning. She knew Prince Andrew was in the same yard as themselves and in a part of the hut across the passage. But this dreadful, incessant moaning made her sob. The countess exchanged a look with Sonya.
"Lie down, darling. Lie down, my pet," said the countess, softly touching Natasha's shoulders. "Come, lie down."
"Oh, yes, I'll lie down at once," said Natasha, and began hurriedly undressing, tugging at the tapes of her petticoat. When she had thrown off her dress and put on a dressing jacket, she sat down with her foot under her on the bed that had been made up on the floor, jerked her thin and rather short plait of hair to the front, and began replaiting it. Her long, thin, practiced fingers rapidly unplaited, replaited, and tied up her plait. Her head moved from side to side from habit, but her eyes, feverishly wide, looked fixedly before her. When her toilet for the night was finished, she sank gently onto the sheet spread over the hay on the side nearest the door.
"Natasha, you'd better lie in the middle," said Sonya.
"I'll stay here," muttered Natasha.
"Do lie down," she added crossly, and buried her face in the pillow.
The Countess, Madame Schoss, and Sonia undressed hastily and lay down. The small lamp in front of the icons was the only light left in the room. But in the yard, there was a light from the fire at Little Mytishchi a mile and a half away. And through the night came the noise of people shouting at a tavern Mamonov's Cossacks had set up across the street, and the adjutant's unceasing moans could still be heard. For a long time, Natasha listened attentively to the sounds that reached her from inside and outside the room, and did not move. First she heard her mother praying and sighing, and the creaking of her bed under her. Then Madame Schoss's familiar whistling snore, and Sonya's gentle breathing. Then the Countess called to Natasha. Natasha did not answer.
"I think she's asleep, Mama," said Sonya softly.
After a short silence, the Countess spoke again, but this time no one replied. Soon after that, Natasha heard her mother's even breathing. Natasha did not move, though her little bare foot thrust out from under the quilt was growing cold on the bare floor. As if to celebrate a victory over everybody, a cricket chirped in a crack in the wall. A cock crowed far off, and another replied nearby. The shouting in the tavern had died down. Only the moaning of the adjutant was heard. Natasha sat up.
"Sonia, are you asleep? Mama?" she whispered.
No one replied. Natasha rose slowly and carefully, crossed herself, and stepped cautiously on the cold and dirty floor with her slim, supple, bare feet. The boards of the floor creaked. Stepping cautiously from one foot to the other, she ran like a kitten the few steps to the door and grasped the cold door handle. It seemed to her that something heavy was beating rhythmically against all the walls of the room. It was her own heart, sinking with alarm and terror and overflowing with love. She opened the door and stepped across the threshold and onto the cold, damp, earthen floor of the passage. The cold she felt refreshed her. With her bare feet she touched a sleeping man, stepped over him, and opened the door into the part of the hut where Prince Andrew lay. It was dark in there. In the farthest corner, on a bench beside a bed on which something was lying, stood a tallow candle with a long, thick, and smoldering wick. From the moment she had been told that morning of Prince Andrew's wound and his presence there, Natasha had resolved to see him. She did not know why she had to. She knew the meeting would be painful, but felt the more convinced that it was necessary. All day she had lived only in hope of seeing him that night. But now that the moment had come, she was filled with dread of what she might see. How was he maimed? What was left of him? Was he like that incessant moaning of the adjutant's? Yes, he was altogether like that. In her imagination, he was that terrible moaning personified. When she saw an indistinct shape in the corner and mistook his knees raised under the quilt for his shoulders, she imagined a horrible body there and stood still in terror. But an irresistible impulse drew her forward. She cautiously took one step and then another, and found herself in the middle of a small room containing baggage. Another man, Timochin, was lying in a corner on the benches beneath the icons, and two others, the doctor and a valet, lay on the floor. The valet sat up and whispered something. Timochin, kept awake by the pain in his wounded leg, gazed with wide-open eyes at this strange apparition of a girl in a white chemise, dressing jacket, and nightcap. The valet's sleepy, frightened exclamation, "What do you want? What's the matter?" made Natasha approach more swiftly to what was lying in the corner. Horribly unlike a man as that body looked, she must see him. She passed the valet, the snuff fell from the candle wick, and she saw Prince Andrew clearly,
with his arms outside the quilt, and such as she had always seen him. He was the same as ever, but the feverish color of his face, his glittering eyes rapturously turned toward her, and especially his neck, delicate as a child's, revealed by the turned-down collar of his shirt, gave him a peculiarly innocent, childlike look, such as she had never seen on him before. She went up to him, and with a swift, flexible, youthful movement, dropped on her knees. He smiled and held out his hand to her. 7 days had passed since Prince Andrew found himself in the ambulance station on the field of Borodino. His feverish state and the inflammation of his bowels, which were injured, were in the doctor's opinion sure to carry him off. But on the 7th day he ate with pleasure a piece of bread with some tea, and the doctor noticed that his temperature was lower. He had regained consciousness that morning. The first night after they left Moscow had been fairly warm, and he had remained in the caleche. But at Mitishchi, the wounded man himself asked to be taken out and given some tea. The pain caused by his removal into the hut had made him groan aloud and again lose consciousness. When he had been placed on his camp bed, he lay for a long time motionless, with closed eyes. Then he opened them and whispered softly, "And the tea?" His remembering such a small detail of everyday life astonished the doctor. He felt Prince Andrew's pulse, and to his surprise and dissatisfaction, found it had improved. He was dissatisfied because he knew by experience that if his patient did not die now, he would do so a little later with greater suffering. Timohin, the red-nosed major of Prince Andrew's regiment, had joined him in Moscow and was being taken along with him, having been wounded in the leg at the Battle of Borodino. They were accompanied by a doctor, Prince Andrew's valet, his coachman, and two orderlies. They gave Prince Andrew some tea. He drank it eagerly, looking with feverish eyes at the door in front of him, as if trying to understand and remember something. "I don't want any more. Is Timohin here?" he asked. Timohin crept along the bench to him. "I'm here, Your Excellency." "How's your wound?" "Mine, sir, all right, but how about you?" Prince Andrew again pondered, as if trying to remember something. "Couldn't one get a book?" he asked.
"What book?"
"The Gospels. I haven't one." The doctor promised to procure it for him, and began to ask how he was feeling. Prince Andrew answered all his questions reluctantly, but reasonably, and then said he wanted a bolster placed under him, as he was uncomfortable and in great pain. The doctor and valet lifted the cloak with which he was covered, and, making wry faces at the noisome smell of mortifying flesh that came from the wound, began examining that dreadful place. The doctor was very much displeased about something, and made a change in the dressings, turning the wounded man over so that he groaned again and grew unconscious and delirious from the agony. He kept asking them to get him the book and put it under him.
"What trouble would it be to you?" he said. "I've not got one. Please get it for me and put it under me for a moment," he pleaded in a piteous voice.
The doctor went into the passage to wash his hands. "You fellows have no conscience," said he to the valet who was pouring water over his hands. "For just one moment I didn't look after you. It's such pain, you know, that I wonder how he can bear it. By the Lord Jesus Christ, I thought we had put something under him," said the valet. The first time Prince Andrew understood where he was and what was the matter with him, and remembered being wounded and how, was when he asked to be carried into the hut after his caleche had stopped at Mitishchi. After growing confused from pain while being carried into the hut, he again regained consciousness, and while drinking tea, once more recalled all that had happened to him, and above all, vividly remembered the moment at the ambulance station when, at the sight of the sufferings of a man he disliked, those new thoughts had come to him which promised him happiness. And those thoughts, though now vague and indefinite, again possessed his soul. He remembered that he had now a new source of happiness, and that this happiness had something to do with the Gospels. That was why he asked for a copy of them. The uncomfortable position in which they had put him and turned him over again confused his thoughts, and when he came to himself a third time, it was in the complete stillness of the night. Everybody near him was sleeping. A cricket chirped from across the passage. Someone was shouting and singing in the street. Cockroaches rustled on the table, on the icons, and on the walls, and a big fly flopped at the head of the bed and around the candle beside him, the wick of which was charred and had shaped itself like a mushroom. His mind was not in a normal state. A healthy man usually thinks of, feels, and remembers innumerable things simultaneously, but has the power and will to select one sequence of thoughts or events on which to fix his whole attention. A healthy man can tear himself away from the deepest reflections to say a civil word to someone who comes in, and can then return again to his own thoughts. But Prince Andrew's mind was not in a normal state in that respect. All the powers of his mind were more active and clearer than ever, but they acted apart from his will. Most diverse thoughts and images occupied him simultaneously. At times his brain suddenly began to work with a vigor, clearness, and depth it had never reached when he was in health. But suddenly, in the midst of its work, it would turn to some unexpected idea, and he had not the strength to turn it back again. Yes, a new happiness was revealed to me, of which man cannot be deprived, he thought, as he lay in the semi-darkness of the quiet hut, gazing fixedly before him with feverish, wide-open eyes. A happiness lying beyond material forces, outside the material influences that act on man. A happiness of the soul alone. The happiness of loving. Every man can understand it, but to conceive it and enjoin it was possible only for God.